Welcome to Influential Visions. Here we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. Here is your host, Nathaniel Schooler.
Well, I am very privileged to be joined by Monique Morrow today, who has supported my podcast for the last few years. And we've done a few interviews where we've talked about AI, we've talked about ethics, we've talked about all sorts of things. So thank you once again, Monique, for joining me. I greatly appreciate you and your time.
It's a pleasure to be here, Nathaniel. And actually, you mentioned all the topics that kind of go together, right? It's amazingly so, and even more important now, more than ever. So you absolutely have a platform that creates these conversations that need to count for the communities.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you joining me, like I say. And I mean, I think it's particularly timely, as you sort of said to me the other day when we booked this meeting in probably two or three weeks ago now. And it's an interesting time right now with all the sort of pandemonium caused by ChatGPT and the people who are panicking around AI and jobs and their jobs and everyone else's jobs. And, you know, there's a lot of research around all of that stuff and there's a lot of panic, but I don't think people need to panic necessarily. Do you agree? Or do you think that there is a need to worry about this?
You know, the lines are a little bit blurred, Nathaniel. I think because of so much dystopian types of background that people have with regards, a misunderstanding with regard to these, to AI and the sets of AI, and especially if we talk about ChatGPT. So with jobs, you know, that what you can imagine that new jobs will be created, new kinds of careers will be made. But let's be very clear. You know, the thing of it is that when you're creating these sets of technologies, you have to create with an intent in mind, in my opinion. This is my opinion. What are you doing? What are you trying to, what's the problem you're trying to solve here? And where does the human fit in all of the loop in the expressions, right? So one of the fears that people have, because remember, I come also contextually from an ethics background, is will you lose the ability to think and to debate? So, for example, universities are very concerned. I see this in terms of their students being able to take text from ChatGPT and then be able to copy it in, and et cetera. And so those are the thing is, will you be able to think? And will you be able to debate cogently, right? So that's one area to be cognizant of. And I think it's also about I think the other component of it is that to be able to keep in mind, you know, what are the broad implications to our society as a whole? And I think in those terms, for me, these technologies have to, especially with AI, have to have an intent. And which organizations are actually kind of trying to benefit from them, right? Are they typical companies, as we see, I'm not going to mention these companies. And if so, does that create a kind of another debate, right? Which companies or even nation states want to own or be able to have leadership in this space. And you can see that certain nation states are absolutely looking in this area and have put it in their strategy planning. So I know it's a big broad answer. So is there a concern? Is there a need to be concerned? I think it's a need to be aware is more important. It's the awareness here. It's the be able to posit questions when somebody is looking at, looking at the implications of these technologies for me. So an example could be what you're seeing is there could be an intersection to education and AI. So you can have the study of computer science and perhaps law. So you create new kinds of disciplines, AI lawyers. I know a group of AI lawyers who actually are perhaps in this space in Switzerland where I live. Metaverse is another topic. It's not directly related to what we're discussing today, but you can imagine metaverse lawyers and metaverse law. So, and then if you have robotics, and then you kind of paint the pictures further and further out, people said robots are going to take our job. Well, robots are taking repetitive. I mean, why do you need repetitive jobs, right? Repetitiveness is an area where it sort of unleashes you to do other things, right? But on the condition that you're able to switch to those new things and be allowed to do that, that's the fear, is that, am I allowed to do this? I do this so well. Am I allowed to do this without being thrown out the door from a company or an organization? And so I think that's what we have to think about. And, you know, when you're thinking of generative AI, particularly in the form of ChatGPT as an example, you have to think about, well, what is it learning? Where can it get it wrong? I mean, it can have this kind of a feedback that says, well, it seems to sound nice. It seems to, wow, this is really cool stuff. But then you have to look at where can it go wrong? It can go wrong in terms of areas of, think about elections that are forthcoming. And I could actually paint a picture of you, and this is happening already, and using generative AI, misinformation about you, and you have right. No recourse. Who owns that? You have no recourse. What does the digital justice button look like? There is none, right? So the genie is out of the hat. To some extent, we have to embrace facets of it with an understanding that we have to know what the implications are to us and the implications to society. And there, you know, what does ethics look like in this space at a wider level?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I saw that picture the other day of the Pope. Yep. With his white puffer jacket on, looking like a kind of hip kind of gangster with his cross and stuff. And but then there was a picture of Obama with Merkel that I think was probably also created. Maybe that was Photoshop. But it's like these deep fakes can be created so quickly now. If there are more than two pictures of someone, I believe these can be created very quickly. And that's the same for, you know, voices as well. So then there's obviously the video side of things and all of these potential negatives. But also, I've been looking into kind of thinking deeply around this stuff. And this is what one of my other guests, Stephen J. Manning, he said, well, you know, people need to actually think. And this is what the challenge is when young people are actually or overworked people are letting the AI run away with itself, then they're not doing what they should be doing, which is fact checking, which is reading it through to make sure that it actually makes tangible sense to people, and making sure that they're using their brains. And this is what, you know, we've been promised these sorts of technologies for so long. I mean, we were promised chatbots that actually were really good. We were promised those, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago, certainly 10 years ago. I remember talking to people about this, and everyone was really hyped and they were really pumped. And then what happened? Like, the chatbots never arrived as they promised. But now I think we're at a place where I can see the ChatGPT and whatever other chats being integrated into all sorts of different things. I'm just looking into WordPress and how I can integrate a nice chatbot to go through all the podcasts and all the content that I have and suggest pieces of content. And I'm looking into that. I'm not going to rush by implementing something that isn't going to work very well. But I think it's quite exciting as a way of also helping people to get better at what they're doing. Because if you're using something that's better than you at writing, you are going to get better at writing naturally. As a progression on you, or if you pay attention, right?
Yeah, I think it's to the point of being able to think. To the earlier, you know, example is to be able to think, to be able to use these tools. So let's look at the positive. Let's kind of switch the gears a little bit. So to be able to use these tools to in a benefit that you see it. You know, maybe it is better writing. Maybe it is better. Maybe it is better reading. Maybe it's better thinking about, oh, how would I I think somebody had actually said, look, I've got this amount of money and I want to, I don't know the specific example, but I want to create a business out of it, and kind of had this chat box, ChatGPT interaction, and there it was. You know, there was a sort of crowdsource, and there was this, well, this is your business plan. And I think that's kind of the positive for that. Also looking at, you know, could we imagine taking a step further? Could we imagine what precision medicine could be with AI overall? Let's remove ChatGPT aside, but AI overall, precision medicine. What does it mean for physicians and patients together to be part of that precision medicine, and look at how AI can actually be used in these particular examples. And I think it's quite interesting and promising in itself. We just don't want to use it. I think it's just as a crutch, you know. It's like, I've got a laptop, I've got, you know, you've got all of these technology devices and you're tethered. And do you walk away? Do you take a walk down in the woods or whatever, or wherever you're out along the beach, and are you able to think, right? And think without, you know, saying, oh my God, I've got to check this or check that, or oh my God, I'm going to, you have to think about when you start to use these, when you have the wellness of your own being. And the wellness of your own being should be part of this conversation. I think that's very, very important, because too often now you have groups, that organizations that are going, wow, we're going to help you find yourself and the wellness of your own being. You've been on this discussion using this particular device, using this particular technology, just as you have for your iPhone, for so many hours or so many minutes. You know, maybe you have to turn that off and have a capability to say, I'm going to turn it off. And I think that's the thing, is knowing how to use a tool for what purpose, such that it doesn't overwhelm you. And I think that's what we have to be better at, and learn that capability, in my opinion.
Very much so. But it's interesting you talk about the medicine side of things, because I was reading something the other day that was referring to basically using AI as a crutch, like you just said, so that it will actually give the patient, certainly in America, worse patient care, because actually the poorer people are going to suffer, is what this article was saying, because actually it's not fit for purpose yet. And this is the whole point, isn't it? It's making something fit for purpose without trying it out on the poor people at the bottom of society, who can't perhaps afford to hire a doctor who's actually going to use AI properly in patient diagnosis and this sort of stuff.
No, and so you actually are touching on another topic that is related. And so that's one area, you know, what could that promise look like for precision medicine? And then, of course, you have the implications, the pros and cons, that to be able to understand that. The other topic is, with these technologies, particularly with AI and its uses, are we creating a digital divide, a north-south divide? Are we creating a divide amongst people within our own society, such that they don't, they're going to be the underserved, right? There's underserved, by the way, if you look at underserved, you know, millions of people underserved from the internet. They're not even connected to the internet. So, yeah. And here, and it's going to get more. And then, of course, let alone what's happening in our so-called very mature societies that are creating these technologies, but creating these technologies without understanding who the underserved, right? The north south, the east west, and so what that means. And so, could that mean that we're going to push people more and more to be underserved? They can't afford it, they don't know what this is, and they can, nobody should use people as experiments, in my opinion. That's clear. I mean, this, I hopefully that's part of the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm, yeah. Right? And there should be something, and I think this, people have, an organization have been thinking about it, the digital, for some time now, is like a digital Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. And AI, do no harm. You have AI for good. You have all of these types of organizations that have been actually growing in over time. So, you know, they look at, you know, what does it mean? Where's the potential for abuse? And how do they use a tool? So here's an example, an analogy. We have the most powerful tools at our hand, but yet when you go learn to drive a car, you have to take a test. You have to take a driving test. You have to take a theoretical exam, et cetera. We are not asked to do that, right? To use these, let alone to use tools like we have, just the basic tools like a smartphone, for example. And so is any wonder that Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, and I could call those individuals out, did not want their kids to have it until a certain age. Why? They knew. They knew. So I think this is the kind of the important, this is an important analogy. These are tools. They're really, really have a lot of power to them. And of course, if we don't know how to use them responsibly, we can do ourselves damage, let alone others. So,
yeah, very, very much so. So in terms of all of these AI opportunities out there, I was reading something the other day and listening to a video that said that it's the most exciting time to be in technology because there are actually so many opportunities to fix problems. But do you think that's true, or was that 20 years ago when the internet was, or longer when the internet was invented?
I think it's a great it's can be somewhat true. It depends. I mean, the technology companies have been laying people off, so you see a lot of loss of jobs already, right? So on one hand, then you see a creation of jobs on the other hand. So, but the creation of jobs, on the other hand, is a ceteris paribus assumption that you have that skill set that is wanted, right? So what happens to the others who, you know, and whatever excuse the companies use, and you know, don't want to denigrate any companies, but the problem, the challenge is that people join these groups in good faith with a skill set that has had been wanted, right, and is no longer wanted. So are we in an AI bubble, maybe the question, like the internet bubble, right? We could be. It's, you know, there's this bubble, have we crossed the chasm? Yeah, we've probably been crossing the chasm for some time now. And so I think that's more now looking at, because there's investors that are looking at how to invest in these types of companies or these types of technologies, especially, you know, looking at some aspects of it. But I think what we need to do is take a step back and say, okay, there is a promise, but there's a promise now on the condition that you are able, again, this goes back to the north, south, east, west divide, to pivot to new skills that are needed. You know, whether or not you take a data science course, or whether or not you take something around these learning language algorithm courses or whatever, there are courses out there to be had. It's a matter of being able to think about how you're going to invest in yourself to do exactly that level of learning, and to be able to build something, do something with what you've learned, and to come back to the workforce in a different manner, you know, where you have that skill set. Now, some people will argue, well, isn't that the job? Isn't that the position of the company to actually say, look, we're going to invest in you? The answer is no. As much as you want to say companies should invest, you know, I know this because I've known this throughout my career, you are responsible for your own career. You're responsible for being able to want to learn or whatever. The company does not have any responsibility to you in that factor, in that matter. So you've got to be able to do that. But that assumes of where you are in these societies. And as to the wider conversation, you know, it's not going to take somebody who's homeless, unfortunately, or who really wants to be able to participate, would really love to participate in these conversations, but cannot, right? Or be able to be inclusive. So what does inclusion look like from this perspective? What does accessibility look like from this perspective? And I think that's a wider, you know, when we go back to how many millions of people are not connected to the internet component of, which is basic, because you need to have this, you know, understanding, then that also has a barrier to success here, whatever success we kind of look at in however way we capitalize on success, right? So I think it's important to note that. And, you know, it's an exciting time technically. I will say this. I don't want to be dystopian. It's extremely exciting time for me. I'm just I'm hungry for all of that, right? So I think this is just fantastic to note that. But, you know, it's buyer beware. You know, what kind of products are you going to create? You know, will we get that right? And for whom and how inclusive are we going to be in this particular new world of new worlds that we are that we're looking at, right? So it is the exciting part of this, you know, Nathaniel, is that it's a journey. Okay, it's not going to take over the world. It's not going to. We're at a journey right now. So this is not something that gets out of the scope or hand. But it's important to have a certain awareness to it. And I think there is a promise, but the awareness has to be very, very. It's incumbent upon all of us. And podcasts like the ones that you have here, creating these kinds of conversations that need to happen, are really, really critical to that right. Learning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, sorry, I just got a question. So when it comes to the way that these technologies work, right? AI isn't going to just take over the world because it's absolutely segmented. Each one of these tasks is segmented and it's designed to work in a certain way. Is that correct? So, because I've been thinking a lot about this. So it's like, look, so you've got this ChatGPT. Yes, you've got a supercomputer behind it and you've got all of this data and you've got all of these words. But that can only be harnessed in the right way if you bolt something else onto it, which creates a separate application, right? So is that a fair way to sort of look at it, that they're segmented into task kind of orientated programs or solutions?
Well, I mean, I think that so yeah, you could say that. I mean, there's a certain level of segmentation, but also I think there's a certain, you know, there are the use case examples, you know, cars, connected cars, travel, tourism, healthcare. That's kind of where my mind is at parsing through your question, you know, travel and so on. I think those are probably a way to think about it. The thing that is kind of important in this particular space is that, so that's one side of it, but where is it grabbing this information? So machine learning is probably something to think about. It's data. It's data that you pulsate. It's data that's learned. It's the machine learning. It's data. And so a classic example of somebody who actually led their AI group in an automobile organization, basically a couple years ago, was kind of turning back, saying to, you know, we had a discussion, and basically when he realized and artificial intelligence, a PhD in this space, but what he realized is that the learning algorithms are learning from conversations in the industry or what's out there. So if it's negative, positive, what we perceive as negative and what we perceive as positive. And immediately, as it was learning and and if you put in, example, if you put in woman, or if you put, it was like housewife or a prostitute or whatever. And it was like, and that's the conversations that were kind of rightfully wrong. I mean, clearly now, I mean, it's not clearly, but we could imagine, but that's what it was learning, right? Learning. And so how do you kind of, this is kind of a fundamental example, but how do you actually understand what control is, right? How do you control what it's learning? We don't, in the sense, because that's the conversations that are out there. Now, people have the right to have their conversations out there, but could we look at what a positive, negative, again, it's all contextual, conversation looks like. It's contextual. So there's context to this, right? To this discussion when we're talking about machine learning, when we're talking about AI, and we're talking about the use cases that go across sort of the industry. So in travel, the thing is, and I want to get into sort of what's kind of embedded here is privacy and trust. So you're profiled. You know, think about it. You got a loyalty card. Maybe you travel often from one location to another, and there's this sort of profiling that's occurring about, and you're served up things. Hey, you were here you want to try this restaurant. You were here. And for you, it's convenience, right? Because it's convenient. You try this restaurant, go to this place, you flew at this a location, maybe you want to try this, et cetera, et cetera. So, and that's been some time now, right? But then it's like, okay, at the convenience, because it's removing friction, at what cost, right? At what cost? The cost is not, the answer is not to disconnect yourself from the internet completely, but is to be aware of how you're dealing with this. You know, especially if you're using, conversation with a colleague of mine just yesterday, you know, your Chrome web browser and what you're putting, the types of things you put in your Chrome web browser, you know, are you aware of that, you know, in terms of privacy, et cetera, and looking at whether or not you go in dark mode or whatever. It's to be able to use these tools. Why is that important? Is because there has to be a privacy and trust component of this discussion where you are in the center, not some technology is the center, and you're able to be selective about its use, right? Because what you don't want to have is sort of something that could be a flip side. You know, I'll come up with always the flip side of this is, so a surveillance, if you will, kind of society, right? A surveillance component. You have created this something that's surveilling you, but at which cost? And some people will say, well, you know, I never cared about privacy. You do when something happens to your identity. You do very much care about it. And so again, awareness of that. And it's part of this discussion that we need to be cognizant of in terms of, you know, how these industries can be used to remove a friction. It's convenience law. But are we aware about how we use these tools to our own self values and trust? And trust is going to be a component of whatever. You know, think about trust. When you think about trust and you think about privacy, what does that mean to you? Well, privacy is like, you know, it's something that's dear to your self being, to your own wellness. And trust is, it's working, but it's going to work until it serves no damage for me, right? There's a component that is very, very key that has to be sort of, do you embed that in these algorithms? Do you say, okay, this is something that has been intentionally created for, as I said earlier, for a certain purpose? Anything over that could be a red flag, And the another analogy, Nathaniel, is that just as you have people who smoke, I don't smoke, but a pack of cigarettes could cause cancer, was the same thing, could cause, not to say the whole long list of potential abuses, but, you know, we should be aware of that.
Right. And then it goes back to the whole conversation that we were having, you know, probably 5 years ago or longer, who owns your data, right? Like, and have you the right to turn around and say to the search engines, right, I want all my data removed on me, and I don't want it to be anywhere in anyone's database and become completely anonymous.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge conversation about who owns your data, right? You know, when you're using some of these tools that basically, you know, whatever your favorite tool is, some way you serve up your data, right? And so, but I would say philosophically, you own your data. You own your data. But to think about how you scrape. So, you know, just on digital identity, digital justice, you know, if you end up in a site that's undesirable, how do you scrape that, right? So how do you go back? And it's a very difficult thing. It's very difficult, mm-hmm. difficult, especially, you know, so there's a lot of miscreant people out there, right? And that's the thing, that just as we have miscreant people in our society, the first miscreant users of these types of tools are the very ones you're trying to protect yourselves from. They're the first adopters, in fact. And I think that's the polarity in this discussion that we have to be sort of cognizant of. I mean, it's, as we said, it's a new world for us. There are certainly benefits in terms of, you know, learning new skill sets, et cetera. There's certainly cons in terms of, you know, the potential for misuse, and there is a large potential for that. And then, of course, widening this digital divide between the haves and have-nots, country level, societal level, where people no longer will be beneficiaries. And that's the challenge that we have in our society. You and I are having this conversation, but, you know, think about somebody who is not able to have this conversation, who could have this conversation, but would not, is not included. So the inclusion component is lacking, in my opinion.
That's a very, very good point, actually. Very good point. So, I mean, I think it's something like 49% of the population of the world isn't on the internet. That's what I heard last time I spoke to someone about this. I did a bit of research. But in terms of kind of what amazes you the most around AI and this new kind of wave of amazing technologies, I mean, I'm really interested in the health kind of side of things, as I know you are, and the way that images can be analyzed and sorted through with these algorithms to indicate types of cancer within, you know, even from people's smartphone cameras. I believe that there's a whole new wave of kind of analysis for these sorts of challenges for people. So the way medicine is kind of moving, that excites me. What excites you about AI right now?
I have to say, I likewise, it's medicine, right? I mean, that's why I touched on healthcare in the beginning. You kind of have to sort of make personalize the experience. My mother passed away with breast cancer, and my aunt did, and her sister, and so you kind of look at this. You look at that experience and say, well, could we have thought about finding these tumors or the propensity? DNA is a very heavy topic here. This is a different kind of component, but of the conversation. But could we have actually used better imaging? Could we have actually used better predictability here with a tool set like AI, right? So with what predictive is, right? And I'll put predictive in quotes. And would that be? Would that have been a better outcome? Let's say for my mother and my aunt. The answer is I don't know, but predictive medicine is I think a promise here. Again, on the condition that we'll have where the patient has to be involved, right, in these conversations. I'm certainly even if I put myself in the patient's shoes, involved in these conversations, and so because physicians are not they don't know everything, right, and they're trying to learn. They're by themselves are trying to learn and keep up with these types of technologies, in some cases. And so, so I think that's kind of the promise of that, in terms of predictive precision medicine. And then, of course, the decision is always going to be left up to you. This is important, not the doctor, but you, right? So here's the component of who you are, Nathaniel. Here's the component of what we found about you. And that's what I think is going to be quite interesting. The other thing I will say here is, on the condition, I'll put my on the condition, you know where that data is going. You know, it has to be, if it's transparently, it has to be transparently, you're selectively part of that conversation of where it's going, how transparent that sharing is. You know, is it your insurance provider will want to be part of that discussion? You know, who else, right? So that's what you're finding is physicians are kind of opening up to these kind of very, very proprietary meta portals. Here it is. You can upload. It's kind of rudimentary, by the way. But again, it's all, but being able to use these kind of tools in a way that's responsible, such that if your premium's going up, why is your premium going up? You know, is it because of the findings here, or what? You know, is it, how is that part of the conversation? And again, being able to be selective of that sharing is, I don't think we're quite there yet, but I think that's an important component of that conversation. But I think the other part two is, I know speaking to people who really need to have access to big data for genomics, that's a really, you know, genomics is each DNA is very special. And researchers really want to have access to that data. But at which price, right? You know, and again, to the previous conversation, predictability and precision medicine and responsible use, such that it's not going to go out irresponsibly, that I mean, without your Nathaniel's control, let's say, to say, well, Nathaniel has a certain DNA and it's, you know, it's in sort of the genomic category, and you know, this is what is predicted about him and his family and so on and so forth. So there's a promise. We've been along this journey. We're at new frontiers in this journey. It's getting better and better and better. It puts pressures on physicians, however, because they have to have, as I said before, a common understanding of these technologies and how to use them, and use them authoritatively, you know, with a partnership with patients in mind. The other component, before go back to you, is I think, again, tangentially related, is how to use these technologies to train healthcare providers and retain them. You know, so topic in mind is metaverse, and okay, there's AI involved in that discussion. I say metaverse. So there are schools in New York that are nursing schools, or nursing, for example, as an example of this, already using these technologies for some time to do that. Why? And of course, with the patient in mind, and patient part of that process, there's a sort of imaging, 3D kind of imaging, that they're part of that. It's not just the cool use of a tool. It's actually being able to see clearly, to see something other than taking somebody's vitals, but to see it in a third dimension at the same time. And so, and that is becoming very, very interesting. This has been going on for the past several years now. And I think, and you see that, I quoted the United States, but you see it also in Asia. So I think this is something that I think we have the promise for, is retaining, educating new healthcare professionals with these kinds of tools. And of course, it will be sort of, what does responsibility look like as we're in new frontiers of it? So it's exciting.
It is. It is. I know there's a chap in Manchester who's doing a lot with limb amputation reduction.
Yes.
Which is something to do with Oracle's image recognition analysis kind of product that they built with him, I think. And that's particularly interesting. I'm quite amazed actually at how that's working, and that has the potential to roll out, you know, globally, doesn't it, for all sorts of different diseases, and it will help a lot of people, I think. Just that primary sort of source of technology, you know, which is really interesting. So what really excites you then about your life right now, and what you're kind of working on over the next in the next year, 2 years, and moving forwards?
Yeah, I'm well, first of all, I'm excited about being grounded. I think that's more important now than ever, is grounding. And so, you know, you're talking about this balance with your wellness and well-being. I think this is the exciting part. I'm very, and this is really important, I don't say that in tongue and cheek. I have recently been accepted to a PhD program. It's going to take me 3 years in cyber psychology. That's exciting.
Oh, now that I'm interested in that.
Now that's cyber psychology. It'll take me 3 years, and it's for Capital Technology University out of Maryland. But the creator of that is Dr. Mary Aiken, who's of the discipline itself, who is based in Dublin, Ireland, and, you know, the chair is also in London. So, and it's for people who kind of are working, but want to learn something new. Now, cyber psychology has a big build part of it because it's also built into cybersecurity components. So cybersecurity is very important. So that's an example of wanting to learn something new. So that's what's going to keep me excited. And also, you know, I have to say these new frontiers, you know, I call them new frontiers, being able to think about new ways to remove friction in terms of fintech, new ways in terms of looking at how we think about digitalized assets, how people become really responsible with banks. As you well know, you have Credit Suisse and UBS kind of debacle. Now people are very much looking at, oh my goodness, I want to think about being able to have alternatives. And what does that mean? So stable coins are really important. You know, how to use that to actually create new infrastructures and in this space. So I'm, you know, those are the big buckets. And of course, common to that is the ethic component of what I'm doing in the IEEE.
Fantastic. And what are you doing at IEEE? You're guiding them on ethics in there or?
No, I'm actually chairing two groups. I'm chairing, you know, that came out in an industry connections group that I had led, and now it's led by a colleague, colleagues of mine, and for standardization. So it's ethics in extended reality. I'm a chair, and now I'm a chair of ethics in metaverse systems, right? Ooh. So that's and my meeting that's going to come up in about 5 or 6 minutes is going to be another meeting on that for being as a vice chair position. So,
and
that is, look, this has come up for the IEEE component of ethics and work spawned in 2016 in The Hague, when a group of people from organizations and companies came together and talked about what does ethics and autonomous systems look like and how can we progress along a journey of what we create these dialogues. And from that, it's been a journey, right? So, and as I said, we're on a journey in this particular space. And in what I'm doing with the IEEE is these chair positions, is looking at working with groups of colleagues from various backgrounds, you know, ethicists and transhumanists and, you know, academics and so on, to create standards that we can actually adopt in the industry.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. No, I was going to say, and what's important for organizations and companies to actually adopt. So, yeah.
Well, thank you. That's been a very interesting conversation. I greatly appreciate it. And yeah, I look forward to speaking with you soon. I'm just going to push the outro.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thanks.